Hello, I'm Paul Vanvis, the host of Curiosity Never Retires from OLLI at American University. OLLI stands for the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, a national network of adult education organizations dedicated to helping mostly retired seniors teach and learn subjects that they have been interested in for years. OLLI at American University in Washington, D.C. offers so many classes on so many subjects that we're producing these podcasts about some of them so you can decide which ones to take. Among these many topics, the most popular are often ones that help the students understand important issues and institutions of the day. And it's safe to say that no institution is more central to the issues of the day than the United States Supreme Court. Penny Hansen has been teaching about the court at OLLI for more than a decade and is back to do so again this fall. Thanks for coming in to talk to us about your course, Penny.
Good to be here.
The court just began its October term recently and is expected to hand down some major decisions. But while those will be important, your class is really about giving your students some context for understanding both the court's decisions and its history. Isn't that right?
Yes. It's aimed at the idea that there are very, very many intelligent and highly credentialed people going to OLLI. We have a wonderful group of people here. But many of them have absolutely no background and no experience with the Supreme Court. But they've come to the conclusion, as I did many years ago, because I knew nothing about it myself, that it is an institution that is impacting their lives probably even more than the Congress of the United States now. And so there are many people who have taken my course, it's been a wonderful response, who don't know, even though they know a great deal about many things, they don't know much about the Supreme Court.
What do you think is the most important role that the court plays in our constitutional system?
Right now, it might be the role of a savior. I don't know if I can talk about it on a truly historic basis, but I do believe that the Roberts Court, which is what my course is about, will probably be bookend with the Warren Court of many years ago, because it is proving to be the most conservative court we've had in decades. And so if you take the Warren Court and you put it on the apogee of literal thought, when you get to the apogee of conservative thought, I think the Roberts Court will probably get that crown.
Let's compare those two, or let's contrast those two more closely. If the Warren Court was about expanding rights and legal protections for groups that had been marginalized at best and oppressed at worst, what is the Roberts Court doing to that legacy?
I focus my class not on everything the court has done, but on some six specific areas that I think they have made major difference in. One of those obviously is guns. It was this court that made the Heller decision that moved us from militia focus on guns, which was taken for granted until that decision, all the way through to an almost anything goes kind of decisions. So there's one. The environment certainly has come to full flower under the Roberts Court and is also now under major threat by several decisions that are being made having to do with a very important issue of global climate change. We also have a political dynamic going on now that no one can deny is less than historic, and the court will play a major role in that and have been building up to that for some time. It isn't just the advent of the Trump court, although that has caused a kind of political cataclysm. It's also the fact that the court is a conservative court and has been an ever more conservative court, and that has played out in terms of presidential power as well, which is another area that I talk about. So I have, as I say, about six areas that I focus on, but in no way is it comprehensive of everything that the court is doing.
Well, I don't want to get too deeply into the legal weeds, but what you are talking about here, in some ways, the whole question of precedent, which is always been one of the, use your metaphor, key foundations, pillars of the entire legal system. What has been the role of and the use of precedent by the Roberts Court, and has it been different from the past?
The Roberts Court is evolving on the subject of precedent more than any other subject. There is Clarence Thomas on one end of the spectrum who says that we should be making decisions, we being the court, should be making decisions, quote, unpolluted, that is his term, by stare decisis. So that is a very extreme position. But there are also numerous other people on the court who are advocates of textualism and originalism, which are sort of the new, shall we say, labels on conservative thought having to do with this right now. And textualism and originalism are relatively new concepts. They were essentially invented by Justice Scalia and colleagues. So that was not that long ago. So it is a new concept in conservative thought on the court, and it's having a tremendous impact. And it is aimed directly at precedent. I just taught a class. Half that class was on the subject of precedent and the evolution of precedent through the Roberts Court, through the 20 years. We are at the 20th anniversary of the Roberts Court. Its 20th anniversary is this week. And it makes it a particularly important time to take a look at the whole subject of precedent and the what the Roberts Court has evolved from and to.
So if the Roberts Court has, I won't say ignored, but largely reduced the importance of precedent in its decisions, then we really are in a legal revolution.
Yes, we are.
What's been the biggest change you've seen in the years that you've been observing and teaching about the court?
Well, I've been very fortunate. I limit my class to 30 people, and so I get to have some interaction with the class. It is mostly a kind of lecture class because people are there because it is advertised for people who are citizens rather than lawyers. Although I always have a half a dozen lawyers in the class, people who haven't thought about constitutional law very much since they got out of law school are frequent attendees of the class and help me out because, of course, as a non-lawyer, there are terms that show up that I have to ask them about.
What is the biggest change that you've seen in the court and how it functions during the years that you've been observing and teaching about it?
It is the evolution of the people, because this court has had 17 members.
17 members.
Since Roberts began. So since Roberts began, there has been an evolution in the court of almost a complete turnover, 89% to be precise. And all we have left of the court that John Roberts joined 20 years ago this week is Clarence Thomas. He is the last remaining member. So it's an almost 100% turnover. And in that time, we have had the continuation of a series of Republican-appointed justices, and those justices have grown more and more conservative with time, particularly when the three Trump justices were added to the court. There was a quite dramatic change. The court had been a largely 5-4 court, meaning all you had to do was swing one justice to the left or to the right, and you could get a different kind of decision. Now with a 6-3 court, it is much more difficult, and the conservatives are really quite dominant. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have some 5-4 decisions, because we do. And every now and then, the liberals actually prevail, but it's rare. And it has become, in this period, essentially a very conservative court, espousing all sorts of positions that I think a court as little as 10 years ago would have found to be really shocking.
Are you going to talk at all about the shadow docket?
I am probably going to avoid talking about the shadow docket as long as I can, although I've already brought it up a half a dozen times. It's impossible to avoid. But my course has always been teaching about the heart of the Roberts Court, which is making decisions on what's called the merits docket, the normal way that the court proceeds. And so I have a 9-week course built on the traditional foundation of the merits docket. But the shadow docket is now in full-scale use all the time. That is really a phenomenon of this very year. Although the shadow docket began to be used maybe 4 years ago with some regularity, it's on steroids now, and it is used weekly. I believe there have already been 25 of them. And we're not even two-thirds of the way through the year. So it is a very important subject. And to tell you the truth, Paul, it's going to be a real challenge to integrate it into my course without throwing out a whole bunch of things that I think it's important for my students as citizens to know about what's going on in this very important institution.
We should just take a short detour here and say the shadow docket was for a long time called the emergency docket.
Yes.
And it is appeals from lower courts mostly, or from appellants, or lower courts, asking for a decision ahead of the briefings and the arguments and all of that. And so the court will make a decision and without explaining its decision, just make a summary decision. And that is in direct contrast to the sort of logic of the court, which is that the court has to explain the legal precedent and reasoning behind why it's come to this conclusion. Okay, the reason I bring it up is because one of the questions that has been raised about the court for years and years has been, why do the two political branches, the two elected branches, even listen to it? There's nothing in the Constitution, as you know, about the court being able to review laws passed by Congress or actions passed by or made by the president. But I've always held the position that the reason that these elected officials listen to these 9 non-elected judges is because everybody understands that somewhere in this process, somebody has to act as an arbiter. And in the end, they need the Supreme Court to finalize some things, to come to an agreement that the political branches can't come to. The reason I'm saying all of this is, if the court's not going to do that, what's the future of the court?
Oh my, that's a very, very big question. The bottom line is, what's called the shadow docket now used to be called the emergency docket. And in actual fact, anyone, including you and me, can go to the emergency docket and say you have an emergency. In the past, it was used almost totally by people who were about to be, shall we say, judicially murdered the next day when someone was going to be electrocuted. The day before, there would be an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court by that individual and his lawyers. Now it is still called officially the emergency docket. The shadow docket term is considered pejorative. There are many people who do not like it, who feel like it's denigrating of it. And there is a new term, the interim docket, being presented by no less a person than one of the justices themselves. But in the meantime, it has also become a repository for questions having to do with far more substantive matters than anything that anyone would normally call an emergency. It's simply that somebody wants a fast answer to something. I do devote a lot of time to this subject in one of my classes because the emergency docket has changed its function, root and branch, in the last 5 years. And we have to take it seriously because serious issues are coming at it every day. Now, this has been put on steroids by the Trump administration, and one of the reasons is that it is relatively easy to call it an emergency if what it's responding to is an executive order of the president rather than a law that is passed by the Congress. And the Trump administration has put forth so many of these executive orders that they are being challenged over and over and over again almost immediately. There's an order, and then there is a challenge. In any event, it's very interesting that these shadow docket has been called forth to make what might be, in other cases, a constitutional decision. No one would have dreamed a few years ago that they could possibly do such a thing. And I think that will be challenged probably at some point in the Congress.
Penny, just from this conversation, I can tell this is going to be a riveting class. So thank you for coming in. Curiosity Never Retires is produced by myself, David Flaxman, Andrew Heller, and Jesse Williams, and is presented by Ollie at American University. Our theme is education music from background music for video by Pixabay. For Curiosity Never Retires, I'm Paul Vanvis. Stay curious.